everyone, and welcome to another episode of Double Shelix. I'm Sally.
And I'm Kayla, and today we are very excited to be talking about patient stakeholders in biomedical research with our guest, Kevin Fowler. I'm really excited about this episode, and listeners, I know that not all of you may be working in biomedical research, but I think all of us have stakeholders in our research, and a lot of time we don't stop and think about who those people are and what their interests might be. And I think even if you're not working in biomedical research, this is going to be a great episode to reflect on who those people might be and what you need to think about from a research perspective. So let me introduce our guests. Kevin has over 25 years of experience in the pharmaceutical industry, and he's worked in a variety of types of positions: sales management, public affairs, global marketing, patient advocacy, which is why we're talking to you today, Kevin. So in 2014, Kevin founded his own patient advocacy and engagement consulting business called The Voice of the Patient. And he's been working with a variety of pharma clients, which we'll talk more about. For this work and his work in patient advocacy, he was awarded the American Society of Transplantation Transplant Advocacy Award in 2021. And he's been contributing to a variety of research articles, as well as the patient editor to the Clinical Journal of American Society of Nephrology. So lots of interesting work. We're really excited to talk to you about this. Maybe we can start by talking a little bit about The Voice of the Patient. Kevin, could you tell us more about the history of The Voice of the Patient, what it is, what you're doing?
Yeah, happy to. And thanks again for the invitation today, Kayla. I, as you alluded to, I worked previously in the pharmaceutical industry, and I just had a really bad experience. And I just said to myself, I'm done working in corporate. And so I started out with one client, and I just saw a business opportunity to help get these clinical trials enrolled with someone that had my professional and personal experience with kidney disease. And so took a big leap of faith at the age of 53, but I've been doing this now for almost 9 years, and I absolutely love what I do because it also affords me a lot of opportunity to do a lot of volunteer work as well. So my professional and volunteer life really are all in one area, improving the lives of people with kidney disease.
Nice. So tell us a little bit about how it works. Like, what are you doing on a day-to-day basis? How is your relationship with pharmaceutical companies work and involvement in clinical trials?
Yeah, so it's a variety of different ways. So I'll give you a recent example. I just came back from the American Transplant Congress in San Diego, and I was at the meeting, for the duration of the meeting. And so when I was there, I was meeting with investigators on this clinical trial for chronic active antibody mediated rejection. So I was meeting there, engaging with them, just seeing, if we could remove any barriers to help improve enrollment for an area in which no treatment exists. And so I think also it's not just the providing perspective of helping these trials get enrolled, but it's also a different perspective of what the clinical trial may mean. So for example, some of the doctors may be nitpicking at some elements of the trial, and sometimes they lose sight of the unmet need. So like in the case right now, this trial I'm working on, there are no treatments. And imperfection is, I think it's just, leveraging the experience of working in pharma, but also of experiencing kidney failure myself. And then there's other ways. There's another company I'm in the process of starting work with in early stages in kidney transplantation as well. And I'm helping to translate my experience in this field from 15 years as they try to get started in the marketplace and establish credibility. I could go on and on, but there's different things, but it's not just transplant. It's where my real interest lies on the early intervention of kidney disease, which is a huge unmet need in our country.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're reaching out to patients and also giving advice to companies about what patients are actually interested in. As you were saying, I really like the quote that you were referencing, perfection is the enemy of progress.
Yeah, that's thank you for saving me there. Yeah, that's a much better choice. I think I think I really view my role as a bridge to the patient and nephrology community, and able to bridge the experience working with pharma to serve as a way to connect with patients and bring those two groups together. And I think at the end of the day, that's really the biggest part of it. And then I think the part that differs too is that just the treatment of kidney disease in the United States has not been great. And that's another thing I work upon volunteer-wise, is how do we provide better care for people with kidney diseases? And happy to expand upon that statement.
Yeah. So can you talk us through, whether it's from your personal story or from, you know, the quote unquote average patient experiencing kidney disease, what is their experience like? What kind of are the big hurdles that these patients might face? And I think that can help our listeners understand the kinds of problems that you're trying to solve through Voice of the Patient.
Yeah. So I would say that, you know, our system of care in the United States up until 2019 has been structured to reward kidney failure. Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, it's about putting people on dialysis.
Because dialysis is a recurring source of revenue for the many non-patient stakeholders?
Well, I would say this is that the dialysis industry in the United States became centralized, and a lot of power became concentrated in those two organizations. And if you look at the literature out there, that centralization has had a very negative impact on innovation. And so, you know, I had my mother on dialysis. She was on there for 4.5 years, died at age 52. And so seeing the experience of her being on dialysis and what that was like, and then having nephrologists tell me it's not that bad, that just it's incendiary when I hear that. And so where my passion is that the people that have kidney disease in this country have not received the best care, and I'm being diplomatic. And so I think that part of the problem is that the patients that have kidney diseases, low expectations have been set for them. And that's just not acceptable. So if you look at comparatively people with cancer, you know, you look at all the different treatments that are getting improved on an annual basis for cancer. Why should we accept being put on these machines, having a terrible quality of life, not being able to participate in life? It's just wrong.
Yeah. What you mentioned there, that this is actually a really difficult situation to be in. Can you tell us a little bit about what being on dialysis looks like on a daily basis?
Yeah. So I you know, personally, I've not been on dialysis. Let me knock on wood here. I had a preemptive kidney transplant. But, you know, just going back and look at a couple examples, just see what my mom went through back in the 1980s. And it really hasn't changed from that time till now. You know, it's just, you know, when you're going through dialysis, most people are getting the absolute, if you're on hemodialysis, which is the majority modality in the United States, you're getting the minimal amount of toxins cleared out of your body, about 10%. And part of that is that the structure of the hemodialysis units are all predicated on patient volume. So you're getting very little amount of your toxins cleared out. The people that go in there, you know, it's a process where many times their blood pressure can go high, can go low, they feel nauseous. And it's almost like when I used to see my mom go through this, is just getting through it in itself was a challenge. And so just when you get back and you're recovering from dialysis and starting to feel better, then you're going to hemodialysis in a couple of days. Now that's hemodialysis. And so you have a fistula that causes disfigurement in your arm. And, you know, you could just look at people who are on there and you can just see they're not as healthy as they can be because they're having the minimal clearance of dialysis. Now, if someone chooses to do home dialysis or peritoneal dialysis, those are better treatments and better clearance of toxins. But the rest of the world does much more home and peritoneal dialysis than the United States. The United States has like one of the lowest rates. And part of that is the infrastructure that was created. And what I like to see is that infrastructure and see those bricks begin to fall apart and give people their freedom and life back.
That totally makes sense. So you came into this with personal experience, either through loved ones, other patients, same I know, and then you are working in the pharma industry. You see that there's a disconnect, and that's where you want to start bringing these two worlds together.
Yeah. And it's also another number of things happening too, right? It's like, you know, I always tell people, I said, this is what I'm supposed to be doing in my life. It's not that big a deal. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so a number of events converged together. The Advanced American Kidney Health Initiative that was issued in 2019, that worked on by Alex Azar, was the most profound change to treatment of kidney disease. Essentially, it was a federal intervention to say that we need to provide better care. So I think it's just, you know, it's kind of funny. It's the personal experience seeing, you know, my mother and her sisters on dialysis and dying, and then receiving the preemptive transplant, where I just felt so grateful to be one of those less than 3% people in the United States that have that. And then combine my business experience. So I take all those different perspectives and I'm able to look at these from multiple situations. But at the end of the day, my responsibility is to the patient community and nephrology community. You've built the business and you've been able to become established, then you have the additional benefit of choosing who you want to work with. And there is a sense of freedom from all this, is that, you know, unlike working in a corporation, no disrespect, but this affords a certain, and that's probably one of the most enjoyable parts, is just the freedom to be who you are and what you want to.
We have had consulting guests in the past that have really appreciated that aspect of their job as well. So that totally makes sense.
And the better part, I'm not working for a larger consulting company. I'm working for just a just me. So there is even more freedom.
How do you get connected with your pharma clients?
Yeah. So, you know, so I first started, someone I worked with previously referred me. And that was supposed to be like a 6-month engagement, and it turned out to be 3.5 years. But after, you know, since then, is that, you know, it's a case where I keep track of the marketplace, I keep track of where the companies are going. And so in some cases, I contact the companies myself. I've had a couple of situations where I've actually, people have referred me. But I think what I try to do is I keep, you know, I'm always talking to see where the market's moving, and try to, you know, I get to know a lot of the nephrologists. And I'm just very proactive. If I see something that's of interest, it's not a conflict with something else, I'll just contact the senior management and just say, I think I can help you.
That sort of describes pretty well how you're able to kind of keep the pulse on the pharma and provider side. Is there any differences with how you can keep the pulse on the patient community? Like you were talking about how your passion is, you know, early intervention and being prospective rather than reactive. Do you see, like, how do you keep the tabs on the patient community? Are you having a lot of one-on-one interaction with patients, or is that something that you do for your clients that are like need finding?
Yeah. So there's, and that's a good question, Sally. So I think there's like, you know, a number of people that friends you've met over the year who are also advocates. And so there's like a certain community there that I stay in touch with. And then if there's engagements I have where they can help, let's say, for example, an advisory board, then I always try to include them in there and make sure that it represents the people that have the disease, meaning not just everyone, you know, that is just close, who looks like me. But, you know, many of my African-American friends are Hispanic friends who, you know, who endure the burden. So I think just trying to make sure at the end of the day, you're really representing the community.
Yeah, that's rough.
Especially in this disease, really in this disease. 35% of people on dialysis in the United States are African-American. 13% of the population, but yet 35% of the people in the country are on dialysis are African-American.
You know, a patient, they have a lot of other aspects to their lives. And so how are they balancing their identity as a person with their patient advocacy? It might get to a point where they don't have a break from the patient part of their life.
Well, so I think I can make a, you know, I'll just say how I make the distinction. I when someone just, you know, when they refer to me as a patient in a professional setting, that's just like taking your fingernails on the chalkboard and I correct them, right? So I'm someone who has been living with a kidney transplant, but I'm someone who's also met with Secretary Azar that has experience recruiting. So I always try to make the distinctions, because what happens sometimes, people try to put you in a, will try to devalue and commoditize you. And so I just correct them and just say, you know, by the way, that's one part of my life. I've also written and been co-authored in over 20 articles. And so I just try to, I'm very assertive on that front. And I think most people are. It's just, you know, we're not this like this, you know, monolithic group. I mean, how do you think I got my kids through undergrad and graduate? It didn't happen through some type. I didn't win the lottery. I had to work to do that. So I always make sure to make that distinction very clear.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think you bring up a great point about avoiding being a commodity and avoiding being depersonified in this process.
And I, you know, and when someone has tried to do that, I just say, no, thanks.
Well, this sets us up as a nice transition to take this into research, because, I mean, Most of our listeners are researchers, and I would wager that most of them are in more of a basic science space. So years ahead of what's going to be even at the clinic, this is where our listeners are doing research. And I think, you know, in my past experiences in other fields, I have at times interacted with people who are experiencing one of the conditions that I'm researching. And I have found myself unprepared for those interactions because usually someone's first question is like, oh, well, when is a treatment going to be ready? Or what are you doing? And so I think one of the first questions that as a researcher, we should be asking ourselves, but I would also love to hear your perspective on is, what do people want to know, especially patients of the conditions that we're researching? What do they want to know about what we're doing?
Yeah, I would say is I hope that their research is focused upon solving the primary problems with kidney disease. And the primary problem with kidney disease is that if for someone who goes into kidney failure, and whether they have a kidney transplant or on dialysis, they're not optimizing their life. Now, in my case, you know, I've been able to be fully employed and everything. But if you look at, let's say, for example, people on dialysis, I mean, I think it's 80, 90% of people on dialysis are not working. They have terrible quality of life. And the data says that within 5 years, 60% of people on dialysis will be dead, right? And so dialysis was originally intended to be a transition to transplant, not a final destination, which has happened, right? Which is fundamentally wrong. And then I think the other thing is that you look at kidney transplant, you know, quality of life is a huge unmet need. And half of kidney transplants fail at 10 years. And some people think that, oh, go to no dialysis is not that big a deal. You know, if you look at evidence out there, researcher Allison Tong said that has shown that patients prefer death over being on dialysis. So I think if you take a look at the landscape right now, I would just say is that I would hope researchers are out there, the best and brightest, are working towards a future with no dialysis, that all these dialysis centers will close, companies like DaVita will go out of business or have to change to something else that provides value. That would be my hope, is that as people get into this area that there's a shortage of researchers in kidney disease. And I think, I guess my hope would be is to educate these individuals on why we need the smart people here to create this world without dialysis. Because it's just unacceptable, unacceptable. And so that would be my plea, really, is to maybe pull together a group, or I guess maybe my request is to pull together researchers in a room and have them talk to people who have experienced kidney diseases and to serve as a motivation to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, at least in a lot of academic research, you know, it's all about taking the next step, you know, like, oh, we learned about this protein. Like, what does that bind to? Or like, oh, we have a dialysis machine. Like, let's make it function 10% better. But it sounds like what is really needed for these kidney patients is not just a next step, but like a paradigm shift and a total transition to like another level of thinking, another level of care and innovation, which we have seen, like to compare to your earlier example in the cancer space, you know, it used to be chemo and radiation, but now we have CAR T cell therapy, which is like a next paradigm shifting level of treatment. But it sounds like what you were saying with your parents' experience in the 80s, like dialysis is basically the same as it was before I was born. So where's the next level?
And you know, and you're exactly right. And so I think if I would just say this is something you can look at too. I learned this through a role serving as an advisor to Kidney Research Institute. There was a physician named Belding Scribner. He was essentially like the godfather of dialysis. He was at the University of Washington. But his belief was that if you're going to go on dialysis or have any type of kidney failure, that you need to be rehabilitated. And so I think if you look at the landscape today, that vision has never happened. And in fact, he warned against hemodialysis centers forming because he saw all what was going to happen. And I'll just try to be polite that vision has not been achieved. Nowhere even close to it. And it's just unacceptable, Unacceptable.
So obviously your passion and experience is kidney patients, but I think a lot of our listeners will have experience as a patient or as a loved one of a patient in some other therapeutic area, whether it's like a parent with cancer or like a sister with a chronic illness. How would you advise these patients or these, you know, listeners to, how can patients get involved with, whether it's, if it's not you, like the equivalent of patient advocacy organizations across a variety of clinical need? Because I think a lot of patients are out there struggling. A lot of loved ones are out there like eager to get involved somehow. But I feel like the more rare your disease is, the harder it is to find that group.
Yeah, I think as far as like to figure out how to get, you know, how to get involved, I think I looked at myself, I just kind of trusted myself and kind of knew what to do. And I just kind of trusted my instincts. And I think that's something I would suggest to a lot of people is that I think a lot of people know what their path is, but they don't have confidence. And I would just say, listen to that voice and have confidence in yourself, even when people are telling you you're crazy. That's the hard part. But I think that's one thing I learned when I followed this path is that a lot of people, not my wife. My wife was very supportive, but where many people out there were telling me what I was doing was crazy. And I just, the people I listened to were my very close friends and my wife, the people I really know, and they were the ones that encouraged me. But a lot of the people, other people, block them out.
You do get a lot of advice from a lot of different stakeholders, shall we say.
It's just like, you know who your, but you know who your close friends are, right? The people you know you can count on, they're there. All this other noise, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we also talk a lot in this podcast about imposter syndrome. So I think a lot of our listeners can relate to the confidence part of this.
And the other thing I would say too is that, you know, if you don't think that you're being properly supported, right? I mean, I always say that everyone says, well, they're a patient advocate, or I'll hear physicians say that. But at the end of the day, if you're someone who truly is in patient advocacy, you're not thinking about your life, but you're thinking about the lives of those who are going to follow from behind you, right? That you're going to make their life better. And so I think for me, it gives me a motivation for what I was being given as the fuel, but it's to make it better for those who are going to follow behind us.
And I think that's part of what can make it tricky. And that's part of like why that attitude is so important is that a lot of these technologies just take a long time. So it can be hard to like, it takes a very special person like yourself to know that it's worth the fight, even if you would never, ever benefit from this therapy or like your child would never benefit because it's going to take forever. It's going to have this long time horizon, but it is worth it because, you know, in 2050, patients will be operating at this paradigm shift level, even if the right patients that you meet today probably won't make it there. And I think that's having that long time horizon can be very daunting, but it's important to like know that it is still important and it is still worth it, even if treatments take forever. And
yeah, and I think that's a really nice way of saying it. And one thing I forgot to mention to your audience too is that I think sometimes what I would not is that sometimes physicians may not see things the same way in the patients. And so I think just they need to look at those as two different stakeholders and make sure that the physicians are not speaking for the patients. Mm. They should speak with the patients directly themselves, so there's no filters. And even sometimes with patient organizations, there's filters. So how do you really get to it? You got to get right to the person and hear from them directly.
Mm. That's an interesting point about reaching directly to patients. Someone like me, who is doing basic science research, it's not necessarily something that I've been taught or explained to, like how to actually connect with some of these individuals, especially in a way that's not bothering somebody. And do you have recommendations? Like some of our listeners at this point might be like, yeah, I know that I have a patient stakeholder in my research, but how do I actually meet someone who has an interest in talking to me and like telling me about their experience and telling me things that they wish I knew?
Yeah, I think if you're trying to find people that, you know, or try to identify the right people, I mean, patient organizations can certainly be a very good source. I think there's also looking at blogs out there, you know, people that write, because I think the one part is just because you're on social media and you have a wide reach, sometimes the knowledge is that much deep. So I think there's different ways now with me, you know, with the internet, is to find people out there. And so I think that's the one thing too, is I think it's, but I think you have to do a little bit of your homework to think about like how you want to engage. What I find most times that happens is that the person that wants to engage with the patient community hasn't really thought what their goals are. And so there's not a lot of thought, but sometimes it goes into the engagement with that person. So I always think that's the most important part, is think about why you want to do it and how is this going to help you or solve a problem, and then find that person that matches. I think that's really the first step before even thinking about that part.
And to follow up on that, if from your perspective, what value could you see a basic science researcher bringing to a patient?
I think the value that I see is I'll bring this back to kidney disease. So I would say one is, you know, trying to get people motivated on the unmet need. So I think the value could be is that I could see, you know, let's say in kidney disease, I could see the scientist being more motivated to learn about change in kidney disease than maybe sometimes the physician themselves, right? Because if you start changing reimbursement incentives and you change that, you know, there's a lot of things that can happen. So I think that the part that I find interesting working, I worked with scientists at Pfizer, is that, you know, a lot of them, many profess to be, I think there's like a part, maybe artists with that, but I think they have a unique perspective in why they went into science. And so I think that it's really kind of an untapped area to get the smartest people interested in different areas and then putting their brain power to solving problems. Because I just look at the treatment of kidney disease. My question is, why did it not evolve? Why did dialysis not change in over half a century? Why is quality of life not even a metric in dialysis? How can that be?
My first response is, I think there are scientists who are thinking like this, especially, I would say that we have a different funding incentive structure in the scientific world than, or the academic side than the pharma side. And so maybe we can see that this is, that we do need this kind of paradigm shift and we can see the path forward, but it's actually just really hard. It's a really tough problem to crack. And from a research side, that can get pretty discouraging sometimes. Like you're working really hard and you really want to solve this problem, and it's actually just a really hard problem to solve. And even if that is the answer, like we're trying basically, is there still value that a scientist could give to a patient by explaining that like, here's what we're trying, here's where we're wanting to go, here's the challenge.
You know, again, it's like, you know, I think what you're trying to achieve, making sure you find the right person. I mean, you know, there's some people out there that their level of understanding is this amount, and it's not going to land well, right? But there's other people out there who are involved with the Kidney Precision Project that, you know, have a good understanding. So I think it really kind of find that match. Like if you are trying to determine, like, this is the problem we're trying to solve, and this problem we're trying to solve, this is how it can help the patient community, right? I look at those as a way that there's value, because then that maybe there's an opportunity for the community to be engaged with that. And the other thing I do, Isaac, is to also like look at the research too. Like, where are the areas, you know, that really maybe where the real unmet need maybe is in kidney disease, and there hasn't been advances because there hasn't been strong advocacy in that area. So maybe there's an opportunity to tap into an area that's been overlooked, identify a problem, and then maybe work to create advocacy there.
Yeah, no, that's true. And there's definitely, it feels like there's lots of room for interaction where a scientist could say, I'm good at solving certain kinds of problems. What problems do you have? And on the other side, a patient advocacy group could say, these are the problems we have. What are you able to do about this in a realistic time frame?
And I was just going to say, on a similar note, with your consulting organization or business, how much of the work that clients hire you for is really focused on that kind of initial needs finding area versus like the midstream, like pick from these two options we've identified versus the later stage, like please enroll in this clinical trial? Like, how does your work fall on that spectrum from like idea to product?
I would say most of the times they're engaged with this is generally phase 3, right? When they're starting the larger trial. And And it's a good question, because what happens is that a lot of times these organizations, these innovators, they haven't engaged with the patients before they've started their trial, right? And so if you were to look at the patient-focused drug development guidance that the FDA says, they say you should engage with patients as early as you possibly can and on a consistent basis, because you could maybe possibly solve some problems that I just see a lot of times decisions being made without a key stakeholder, right? And from a business standpoint, it just doesn't make any sense. So, you know, I guess as talking to the audience here is that I go back to it, you know, asking this question about basic scientists. I think going back to, okay, what are you trying to solve as a problem? And then trying to find someone else out there where that matches up with. Because I think if you're going to bring all this forward, the scientists and advocacy, they really need each other, right? To work together.
Yeah, I think that's a great transition point to our more forward-thinking question here, especially since we're getting near the end of time. So what are you most excited about for the future of kidney disease treatment?
Yeah, what gives me a lot of hope is this Advancing American Kidney Health, you know, that was issued in 2019, that executive order. I think that was, you know, that is putting more of a premium upon early detection. And it was a recognition that the treatment of kidney disease was not, it was an intervention essentially by the government. I think where I'm most interested is that there seems to be more of a willingness that we need to do a better job of intervening earlier and detecting kidney disease. You know, the thing I'll share with you is that 40% of people who go on dialysis crash into dialysis, meaning they had no idea that they were in kidney failure. Think about that. And so how can we have something that, you know, so I think that everyone, I mean, even if you're healthy, right, you should know what your kidney function is. And so I think what I'm excited about is this transition from a system that rewarded kidney failure to one that moves up to embracing kidney health. And I give you different examples. Like there's a contrast procedure done, right? Using dye. And those processes are very bad on the kidneys. So those are things that I avoid, but those could cause acute kidney injury for people that have never had any kidney problems, both of you, if you were to go through that. So I think it's just going through like understanding, you know, understanding really kidney diseases. And the truth is, so little is known about this. So people today are like saying, well, we got these SGLT2 inhibitors, everything's solved. Give me a break. You don't really even understand the disease. So I guess if I were to say is that to get what my hope would be is get the really smart people to understand these diseases and then find personalized treatment and have treatment options like you do so that you would never go into kidney failure. It's not going to happen in my life, but that's my vision until I leave.
It just sparked in my mind. I was just listening to a seminar discussing about how kidneys are remarkably good at staying functional even when they're not. You're asymptomatic until you're really in trouble, which is remarkable.
Yeah. Kayla researches kidneys in her real job. You guys are, so both of you are on the kidney forefront.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think when you are going to graduate school, I've seen lots of people entering graduate school and their personal statements, they're like, look, my life was affected by this disease, or like someone I cared about was affected by this. And this is why I want to go into biomedical research. And then you get into it and you're deep into the basic science. And, you know, you constantly have this introduction to your grant application. You're like, I want to solve this major problem. But it can start to feel a little bit out of touch with that clinical problem that you're actually solving after you're like deep in the weeds of a very specific mechanism that you're interested in. I think whatever field that you're working in, it's good to pull back and, like you said, interact with these different stakeholder groups, revisit, okay, what am I really going for? What are we really trying to solve? What's both the next step and the future paradigm shift step? And how can we work towards those in parallel?
Agreed.
Kevin, is there anything else that you don't want to leave without saying?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. I just appreciate the chance to speak with you today and to hear this. And I think you're really onto something in terms of I think there is an opportunity to untapped opportunity to engage with scientists early on in kidney disease, and maybe also just to educate them on the current state. You know, I mean, this may be unpleasant, but almost to take them, see what dialysis is like. You know, even talking to people like with, you know, kidney transplants, you know, there's still, in many ways, you trade one set of problems for another, although I'm not complaining. But I think just trying to maybe understand it a little bit more and become more educated so that you have, that maybe you can think of ways to solve problems that others haven't thought of. Because it becomes like a, right, you know, and you just keep asking yourself, it's like, well, wait a minute, this didn't change until there was a federal intervention. Well, why is that? Mm-hmm. It's not serving the patients. So anyway, that's about all I would really say.
So we have this part at the end of our show that we call shameless plug time, which is one of our favorite parts. So we would love to know if there's anything you would love to shamelessly plug. And it can be something serious, like your consulting business. It can be something silly, like your favorite new TV show. Anything that you would just like to leave our listeners with.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is that, you know, if you're interested in connecting, I'm on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is Grateful. Maybe, I don't know if there's a way to put, yeah, you put that in there when you do it.
Grateful. We'll put it in the show notes for sure.
Yeah, put it in there. And then my, you know, my LinkedIn profile. So, you know, so you know, free to contact me on my contact information. That's it. I mean, just feel free if there's, if interested in talking further. No, but that's it. I'm not going to make a plug for business or anything. No, just if you want to get a hold of me, but that's it. So
awesome.
Yeah, I hope this was helpful.
Yeah, I think the listeners will really be able to connect and to the messages that you're sharing. And at least I've already started reflecting on like my own work, both in industry and my previous work in grad school, and how it goes back to the patients and where those gaps might be.
And I think it just, you know, in the part two is that everyone says they're patient-centered and all that. And that's like one of the biggest lies out there. I hate to say it. But I think if you could figure out ways to get rid of those filters and hear directly from them and compare that between what the physicians and others are saying, and even patient organizations, you got to be a little careful sometimes too. Yeah, I'll just say that.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. They're their own stakeholder in a way.
They got a business to run too, right? And I keep going back to kidney disease. Why didn't kidney disease, the treatment change? Why? I have my theories on that, backed by evidence.
Like who donates to the patient organizations?
Oh, donate! It just gets me so. But the part is like the best part is that I love these bullies and I love taking on the bullies.
Yeah, me
there
too.
You go. Every cause has to have its champion, and you're really, you certainly are a strong one for kidney disease patients.
Oh, thanks. So there's lots of people out there though. There's been people out there. If I would say one thing maybe for audience is to learn about, there was a woman named Celeste Castile Lee. And if the audience can learn about her, she was, you know, there's an award named after her by the American Society of Nephrology has a lecture named after her. There's an award by the National Kidney Foundation. But a lot of the changes we're seeing, the patient voice of kidney disease, are all a direct result of her work on the Kidney Health Initiative. So she influenced my life. I was a volunteer with the Kidney Health Initiative, and she was in my life, and she gave me some of the best advice. She said, you know, her vision is that patients were the stakeholders to solve the problems of kidney disease. And so that was her legacy to me. And I learned from her. And so I think I would just say, is that making it about myself, but think about people we've learned from before, pass on to others to keep things changing. So yeah, that'd be nice to mention her. She had an impact on my life.
Great. We'll maybe find some articles about her work in advocacy and link them in our show notes so listeners can.
Yeah. I'll see if I could send you some, but you should be able to find some on there. And yeah, that'd be really nice. I think that'd be a nice way to honor her legacy.
Awesome. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. This was such a great discussion. I had a great time and I learned a lot.